You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Mets 360 here on Cast. I'm joined tonight by Mike Silva, and we got a little interesting backstory here. Mike was actually going to be a guest on Blog Talk Radio when all of a sudden Blog Talk Radio pulled the carpet out from underneath me and left me stranded. So, Mike, thanks for your patience on joining the show.
Better late than never, and a lot has changed since the last time you and I were supposed to chat. I was thinking back to some of the topics we were going to talk about, and I think things are a little bit different in 30 days or so, wouldn't you say?
Indeed. But before we get started, start talking about the Mets, I want to talk about some of the things that you're involved with. I know that you're involved with Mets Mirage Online, and you have your own media company or something like that. Sounds like your own media company.
It sounds more intricate than it is. But no, at Mike Silva Media on Twitter. I mean, I've been doing radio for about 10 years, freelancing. I used to be on an ESPN affiliate that's now defunct out on Long Island. I have the Talking Mets podcast. I've had different iterations of independent media, if that's what you want to call it, NY Baseball Digest, which was my own thing I started, you know, many moons ago. And now I help Rich Catino, who's on ESPN 98.7. He has a show on Sundays on a Long Island radio station called WLIE 540 AM on the New York Sports Wrap, so I guest co-host there. So I'm kind of all over the place, but primarily every Sunday, if you subscribe to my feed, if you go to MetsMorizedOnline.com, there's the Talking Mets podcast that you get on Apple, and you'll usually get guests and features and my opinion on what's going on with the New York Mets. So hence why I'm on your show, Mets 360, but I'll leave that. You'll plug your own product right now. So that's where I'm at.
Well, clearly Mike knows what he's talking about, so let's get right to it.
Well, that's debatable, depending on who you talk to, but that's okay.
Well, the big topic right now, or one of the big topics, is Jacob deGrom. And his agent here during the All-Star break publicly asked for the club to make up its mind. They want him to either trade him or give him an extension during the All-Star break. So what's your take on that ploy by his agent?
He's doing his job. You can't argue with a guy, an agent, in an industry where agenting is so competitive that he looks at his client. DeGrom is 30 years old. If he does get a long-term contract, if he stays healthy, this will probably be his earning potential right now. There won't be another one. There may be, but not to the level of what he could get at age 35, especially with the way the game values youth right now. So he says, look, my client's having a career year. He's never going to be at a – from a standpoint of publicity, at a better point. Let me go out there and put some pressure on the Mets. It sounds like the Mets have dragged their feet with negotiations. The hope with this may be motivating them a little bit more, forcing them to make a decision. And if he does get traded as client, I'm sure the team that acquires him is going to have to give up quite a bit and want to sign him to a nice lucrative extension. So it makes perfect sense. I don't think DeGrom will be traded, and I don't think the Mets are in a rush to give him an extension. So I think this is more of a – the first move in what could be a rather lengthy chess match.
Now, to me, what I keep harping back to is a couple of years ago when Matt Harvey and his agent spoke up on his behalf and said, look, you know, he's coming back from surgery and we don't want him to surpass an innings thing. And that got met with such an outcry from the public. And you fast forward here a couple of years to what DeGrom's saying, and everyone's just kind of shrugging their shoulders. And is that solely because of the agent, or do you think that there's other things at play here?
I think Scott Boras always elicits more of a negative reaction because of who he is, because of how great he is at his job, because of how polarizing he is. And even though fans usually, you would think, would be in the players' camp, because even though they're very wealthy, the wealthy ones are the owners, and it's amazing how many fans are more empathetic to the ownership plight. I also think Matt Harvey, and I always said this, I never felt Mets fans really believed he was one of them. He was more Page Six. He always was making googly eyes at the Yankees. He talked about being Derek Jeter, so I think that played into it. You know, Mets fans like stars, but they like, I guess, salt-of-the-earth type of stars, David Wright, Mike Piazza, even though those guys could be equally Page Six, I think they're just a little bit different. They're maybe flawed superstars, where Harvey wanted to be the model. And DeGrom, to me, falls more into the Wright-Piazza mold. You know, he's a family guy, he's got a kid, a guy from Florida, doesn't seem to be interested in getting naked on the Body magazine. And I think that's why you see this right now. I guess we'll see if he struggles after this, how the calls to talk radio and maybe some of the tweets and articles and things of that nature. I don't expect that to happen, but DeGrom to me has always been the best out of all these guys. And I said this, and he really won me over in that Game 5 in Los Angeles in the 2015 Division Series when he didn't have his best stuff. And he grinded through that. The Mets were on the verge of getting the doors blown off of them in that game, and they couldn't afford that. With the fact that they were facing, what, Zach Greinke, if I'm not mistaken, that night. And he kept them in the game. They came back, they won, and they went to the World Series. So I think at that point he really won me over. Has a lot of that David Cohn in him, that moxie on the mound.
No, I like the phrase that you use, flawed superstar. And maybe there's no more flawed superstar left on the Mets now than Yoenis Céspedes. And the latest news with Céspedes is he's working out to be a first baseman. And to me, that sounds, you know, promising, that it might actually solve a problem for the club. What do you think?
If he can play it, great. I'm skeptical. Somebody brought up, and I'm trying to remember who it was, but about how big his body is and can he be mobile enough. The one thing that I think everybody forgets is that I know maybe back, at least when I was in Little League back in the 80s, sometimes the fat kid would play first base who was immobile. But there's so much more to the position. I'm not expecting to be Keith Hernandez here, but you have to be able to handle throws in the dirt, you know, bunt plays. I think a first baseman, the stretches, you know, how he holds runners on. I mean, there's just so many things that, especially with a staff that doesn't really do well with the base running, you know, holding base runners on, I think first base is a little bit more important, a little bit more intricate than those, you know, give people credit to. Can Céspedes do this? You know, he's probably the kind of guy that doesn't really give much credence or to stress, so maybe he can. It'd be interesting, and it certainly would help with his versatility. There's no DH in the National League. It sounds like he's got some kind of chronic heel situation, or at the very least, something that will require rest. And then, you know, do you really want a guy who can only play 4 days a week or 5 days a week for the next couple of years of that contract? You know, he's supposed to be your impact bat. So if he can play first, that'll help him. I have my doubts, but it's only a positive. I don't like just throwing guys at positions just to see what the hell. We've seen the Mets do that throughout the history. Howard Johnson in center field, Juan Samuel in center field, Lucas Duda in the outfield. I could probably throw some other guys that I'm forgetting off the top of my head. But, you know, it can't hurt giving it a look, but I really don't know if I would just throw him there and say, hey, he's a first baseman, here's a first baseman's mitt. You know, just because you have a first baseman's mitt doesn't mean you're a first baseman. You or I could put a first baseman's mitt on. Doesn't mean we're first basemen. We probably are not, you know. But, hey, if Greg Jeffries, who wasn't the best fielder, could play first and play it, I guess, decently for the St. Louis Cardinals, you know, anything is possible.
You went to Jeffries. I was going to go a little more contemporary. I was going to say we're throwing Wilmer Flores out there now, and if Flores can do it, I see no reason why Céspedes can't.
Yeah, there's a guy, perfect example of a guy who does not have a position. He's probably a DH. And amazing, the Mets went to the World Series with the Flores playing shortstop, with that footwork, with that long arm action. Very difficult. I mean, he can't really. He's shown he can't play third base. He's probably better at a closer position in the infield. But yeah, and Flores hasn't. I don't have the defensive metrics in front of me, and I don't necessarily buy all those metrics and how accurate they are because it's so hard to assess defense, even with all the kind of statistical tools they have now with GPS and all that other stuff. But you know, I think he's done okay for us at first. I don't think he's a Gold Glover, and I don't think he'd be a guy that late innings I would say, okay, I don't need a defensive replacement. But with his bat and the fact that he hasn't shown it this year, but he can hit lefties historically, and he's hitting righties really well, you know, he's pretty much done what you would ask at that position. Better than what Dom Smith could produce, and you know, certainly better than what Adrian Gonzalez was giving you.
Well, circling back to Cespedes, the one thing that I like about the plan is you face the glut in the outfield where Nimmo and Conforto certainly have to play every day, and if Cespedes is healthy, and who knows, maybe one of these days Jay Bruce will be healthy too, and I guess we've always felt like Bruce was going to be the guy to end up at first base, even though he said more than once that he doesn't want to play the position. So this might be the perfect situation.
Yeah, it's funny because in the NBA now, you have this thing called positionless basketball that everybody talks about. You don't have to have a position. You play all over the court. And we haven't really talked about that in baseball because baseball, if you're a really good Gold Glove center fielder, you're not going to move them to another position. If you're a Gold Glove shortstop or you're Nolan Arenado at third base, you're not going to move those guys. But maybe there is a value to guys learning. And I think at one point there was a value of utility guys like Joe McEwing. I think Rex Hudler was a guy back in the day that used to play a number of positions. You know, Howard Johnson played shortstop, and Davey Johnson's recently been, you know, going on about Kevin Mitchell, if you remember, and he played a bunch of positions. And it's so long ago, it's hard for me to remember how good he was. But, you know, Hojo wasn't a great defensive player, but if you look at some of his metrics, what they do have from back in the day, he wasn't a bad shortstop. So, and that's a value, the versatility of being able to put a guy like that, especially when you don't have a ground ball pitcher on the mound, and maybe beef up the offense a little bit. So it's not a bad idea to start getting these guys to learn different positions. I don't know how the analytics community will look at it, how the media will look at it, or the fans would look at it. But to me, you know what? The hell with that. If it's something they could pioneer with and it makes sense and helps the Mets win, they should try it out. As long as they're not taken away from the guy's offensive game. I think that was one thing with Lucas Duda, if you remember. He really couldn't play the outfield, and I almost feel like it took away a little bit from his offensive game at that time. And he seemed to be much more comfortable and evolve as an offensive player when they put him at a natural position like first base.
I agree with that completely. One thing that that I like that the Mets are doing, and this is in the lower levels of their farm system, they've put such an emphasis on acquiring middle infielders, particularly shortstops, that I have all of these shortstops. So to get everyone a chance to play, you see these guys playing short, you see them playing second, and you see them playing third base. And in one of the lower levels, I believe it's Kingsport, they actually have one of those guys that they signed as a shortstop playing first base just because that's the only position that's available. And I want to see them move that to other positions. To me, earlier in the year when they had a spot available in the outfield, it was almost criminal to me that they had never had Peter Alonso play one game in the outfield. And I'm not saying that they've got to throw him out there and have him play 20 games, but is there any reason that he couldn't play one or two games a month in the outfield just to increase his versatility?
Well, they did it with Dom Smith. I don't know about Alonso, his mobility, but and they did it with not Dom Smith, and it was like there was an outcry. And I think it's amazing to me about how fans and media look at this stuff. If he knows how to play first base and he's increasing his value by learning other positions, I know that's usually reserved for players who are not necessarily top prospects or guys that were first-round picks. Those are guys that are trying to create versatility and value for themselves, so there's a justification to put them on a 40-man roster or a big league roster versus somebody else. But if the NBA could get to the point where versatility and positionless basketball is a big thing, why not look at that in baseball and say the ability, especially now in the National League, where you're going to 12-man pitching staffs, that means you have 13 offensive players, 8 guys starting, let's say 5 bench players, one's a catcher, you have 4 bench players, you know, let's say backup outfielder, backup infielder, You know, you need somebody that could play multiple positions so that if there's a problem, if there's an injury, if there's a 15-inning game, that individual could play pretty much anywhere, let's say, or any infield position, and hopefully contribute offensively. It's going to be more important. You know, it sounds like the DH, even though there's some support for it in the National League, isn't anywhere close to happening. So this almost has to happen because I don't see 12-man pitching staffs changing. I don't see teams having the depth, especially if expansion comes into play, which could happen. You're going to have more bad pitching out there, and you're going to need more relievers. And the shuttle that you've seen this year between Vegas and New York City has been absurd. I think it's actually bad for the players because, in a way, I mean, 1 week you're in Vegas, the next day you're in New York, back, up, down. I don't think it's healthy, but that's a whole separate story. So, yeah, I think it's important, and I wonder if teams are going to start to look at that and say, we need to have a bench, but we need guys on the bench, especially in the National League, that could play multiple positions so that there is that versatility and they can navigate shorter benches and long extra inning games potentially.
And the third big question in the blogosphere, if you will, right now is the trade deadline and how to handle that. And there's some people that think that the Mets are just a little bit better luck and maybe a key acquisition or two away from being back in contention. And there's others who think that we need to blow it all up and start over again. So where do you stand on that spectrum? Do you just deal the expiring contracts now, or do you look to make much bigger changes than that?
I think I'm in the minority in saying that I know that, and I was looking at the numbers and the roster, and it's just so many guys, again, the second year in a row, outside of the four starting pitchers, and Wheeler's just come on recently, so it's really three and a half, are underperforming, but I still see that there's enough here. And a couple of reasons why. A, I don't think they're going to rip it apart now because it sounds like they want to go outside the organization for a GM, and I don't think ownership wants to bring somebody in outside the organization, and that person tells them, hey, by the way, those guys you all traded away for ABC, you could have got, you know, EFG, and by the way, I probably could have built a team around them. You want that person coming in, evaluating the roster as is. I think there's enough. When you have four starting pitchers and pretty solid, and I'll put Wheeler, even though I'm skeptical about how sustainable he is, you have a very valuable bedrock to build at least a team that I think what they have here can make the playoffs. I'm not saying this is a team in the next 2 years that you can all of a sudden turn around and win 9,800 games. I'm not even saying this is a championship team, but if this team, and I don't see why it couldn't, can't sneak in or make a wild card, or who knows? I mean, I keep hearing about the Braves and the Phillies. I've passed them. Well, a lot could change next year. You don't know about injuries. Manny Machado went to L.A. He didn't go to Philadelphia. And even if he did, he's a free agent. You just don't know what next year looks like. Even though there are young players and controllable players, I need to see players go around the league once or twice. Injuries could happen. Underperformance. Nick Markakis is having a career year in Atlanta. That might not continue. You just don't know. So to me, to just punt and say, well, the Braves and the Phillies have arrived. What if these teams did that when the Mets won in 2015? The Nationals did that when the Mets won in 2015. They would have missed out on a couple of divisions. So I'm kind of going around it here, but I think you should try in the next 2 years with the controllable pitching, build a roster, maybe a more diversified roster with some better defensive players, maybe some more diversified offensive players, and go to war with that and see if you can make the playoffs. And once you get in that tournament, it's a crapshoot. If the Mets were bestowed a playoff spot this year and were relatively healthy, they could win a playoff series with this group. I don't think it would be easy. I don't think they would win and navigate to a championship. But with those starting pitchers, they could. Because anything could happen in a short series. If you did a tournament or anything like that. I think a lot of people want them to rip it up and start over and start fresh and build up a farm system, because a lot of fans like prospects now, and they like winning, you know, organizational awards. It's almost like baseball sim dynasty, those old, you know, games that you play. Realistically, I think the Mets are just going to trade their free agents, hopefully, and I know for a fact that it sounds like they're going to try to take money on so that they don't have to settle for lesser prospects. What they can get for a Familia or for Cabrera, or maybe if they want to go and trade Wheeler, I don't know, but it sounds like it's guys that could help immediately. And my only hope is that if they do trade those guys, they get the best possible package. Not necessarily guys that could help the 25-man roster, but have potential. And with three guys running the show, even though they've been in the organization a while, one the former GM and Omar Minaya, that's a little clumsy, but you know, you do have three guys who have diverse skill sets, responsibilities, and maybe in the short term it could work. In the long term, I don't think it could work, but in the short term it can.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that it won't be that way in the long term. And you referenced the fact that it looks like they're going to go outside the organization when, for a time there, it looked like Rico was going to be the guy to take over for Alderson. And I think you made an excellent point when you said that it's not fair for the guys who are in there now to go and blow things up when they're not going to be the ones who actually have to pay for those decisions. It's going to be a new office. But one thing that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, you're talking about, well, you know, if you get in there, anything can happen, and that's 100% true. But one of the things that the readers on my blog are constantly harping about is that we seem to be content with building a team that's just good enough to make it, instead of trying to build a team that's going to dominate. And is that okay to build a team that's just good enough to make it when seemingly everybody who makes it has an equal chance once you reach the tournament?
Well, absolutely you want to build a team that could dominate. You want to build a team that's the best in baseball. There's no doubt about that. I think that, and again, this is John Heyman reporting it, it sounds like the finances, or they claim the Mets, the finances are better. I don't think that was the case even as the 2015 season rolled around. I do think you can win with $160 million payroll. It's not easy when you have, you know, $7 million of a lefty reliever, $9 million of your setup man, you know, another $9 million in a fifth starter. I mean, you're looking at $30, $40 million in dead money. It's also not easy to win when the guy you brought in to be the anchor of the offense, the dynamic offensive player that he could be, Yoenis Cespedes, is making $25 to $30 million. So I just rattled off five or six names. You're looking at $60-70 million. You're looking at about 40% or 35% of the payroll. That's a lot in what really is very light performance. And the only one out of that group that I have any hope, if they stay healthy, that could perform at those dollar values is Cespedes. Now, I did not disagree with any of those moves when they were made, so I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I didn't know A.J. Ramos had a bum shoulder. Who could have predicted that Blevins would go from a highly effective situational lefty to probably one of the worst? Vargas, statistically, he fit what the Mets needed, which was, you know, the dirty dish towel, six innings, three runs. You know, if you do that, you'll keep teams in ball games, and you can win late with a decent bullpen. So I don't think they were playing just to compete and be well. I think they had a good team, and I was curious if these guys were performing as expected, what this would look like. If you take June out, and again, I know this is going to make people roll their eyes, but if you take June out, they're a 500 team. They're 34-34. That's not great, but that's not horrible. That's not worse than the National League. They were historically bad in June, and they lost so many games where not only did they not hit, they were embarrassingly inept. I think statistical outlier, if you look at those first couple of weeks of June, is what I would call it. I mean, no team could be consistently with major league average or below league average or slightly below league average players that bad. So I don't know if this team was built just to compete and win. I think they had higher aspirations for them. And I still think with the kind of starters you have at the top of the rotation, with Conforto, with Nimmo, with Cespedes potentially coming back healthy, you know, they have some interesting young pitchers in the minor leagues that may be available and ready to contribute next year. I don't think that a guy like Todd Frazier is a complete waste. I do, at least if you believe them, they have money to spend to maybe go after an A.J. Pollock or a D.J. LeMahieu or some other type of offensive players that aren't just the, you know, sit back and wait for the three-run homer type. I think they can compete and win, and you never know. I mean, I thought this was an 88-90 win team at the beginning of the year, and they were playing like that by the end of April. Things just went very bad, and I think that a lot of things happened that I don't want to say all of it was a statistical outlier, but some of it, I don't even think the most pessimistic prognosticator would think the Mets could be, you know, 39 wins at the All-Star break. Let's put it that way, or 40 wins, whatever they're at right now.
you've mentioned here tonight that you're not a big believer, not a big fan of Zach Wheeler. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say if you were given the choice to trade either Wheeler or Steven Matz, that you would pick Wheeler. Talk to me about those two guys and where you see them going here on forward.
Well, Wheeler's mechanics have always bothered me. I mean, he had the Tommy John surgery. He had the inverted V or W, whatever you want to call it, back even when they traded for him from San Francisco. I've always felt he's a guy that's inefficient, throws a lot of pitches, muddles through games. He's been much better at this point. Now, I still think he's shown that after 95 pitches, 100 pitches, he's done. Because you see even the games that he's pitched well or dominant, that the numbers didn't really look that way because the Mets tried to push him, and rightfully so, into the seventh inning. That was always a criticism about this staff, except for DeGrom, of course, even with Syndergaard. I never felt Collins and Worthen push these guys to get into the seventh, eighth inning. Look, you want to be considered elite, like Scherzer, like Kershaw. It's not six innings, zero runs. It's not six innings, one run. It's seven, into the eighth, maybe the ninth. I know that's even rare for the elite pitchers. And I think that's what Callaway at least seems like he's trying to do with Wheeler, get that extra, you know, 15, 20 pitches. There's no reason, even by today's ball game and standards, that you can't get 120 pitches out of a starter. I'm sorry. If they're trained properly and they have the ability and they can be effective, you're not going to tell me pitches 101 to 120 are better served giving to a middle reliever, even if they're a solid middle reliever. I'm not talking, you know, Anthony Swarzak, who's had an up-and-down career. I'm talking even guys like A.J. Ramos when they're on, Jerry Blevins when he was on and when he was playing well. I think the starter is still the best option, and you want to make it so that your relievers, you can be situational with them, you don't overwork them. I mean, everybody says, well, they're a reliever, that's fine, but, you know, these guys go every day, and they get hot. Even if they get hot and they don't get into the game, the arm still is being used. The arm doesn't know that it's not being used in a game situation, other than it's maybe a little bit less stress. So, you know, Wheeler to me has always been the guy that I'm not sure about. And there's also been some reports about what would his makeup be if the stakes were higher. We haven't seen that because he was hurt when they were competing for a championship. They've been pretty much out of it since he came back. Let's see what they could get for him. Will someone overpay for him? I think that if someone's going to overpay for starting pitching, you have to at least put Wheeler out there. Now, Matz, you would also put him out there because you never know. But to me, he's lefty. You know, lefties sometimes mature later. I know he's had an injury history. I think his injury history hasn't been as freakish as Wheeler's. I think it's been more freakish than Wheeler's. I mean, Wheeler, you know, has had mechanical issues from day one. I kind of always felt he was going to get hurt. And to me, he's just a better player, Matz. I think Matz is more likely to be the number three starter that could get into a 1-2, whereas Wheeler's a guy that's always going to be, maybe on a good day, a number two type, but more likely he's going to fall into the 4-5 in the rotation with his performance. And those guys are more fungible. But I wouldn't just give them away. I'd try to get something of value, and I wouldn't get, like, low-A players. I try to get players that, if a team is desperate enough and needs a starter, say, hey, you're going to pay for this guy? And you just never know what teams are willing to pay if they get desperate and they feel, well, if I could get another starter, even if he's a six-inning, two runs, or three-run guy, I could get myself in the playoffs and maybe win a championship. You never know what those teams will give up, especially if they have a little bit deeper farm system than another team that's in the same, you know, situation.
I was looking at some numbers earlier today, and one thing that really jumped out at me, I was looking at Steven Matz and his ERA. His ERA is the 20th best in the majors among qualified starting pitchers. And I knew he was having a good year. I didn't realize it was that good. But if you also compare that to his numbers by his peripherals, his FIP is much, much higher than his ERA, meaning that perhaps he's pitching in some good luck. And you mentioned earlier that Wheeler has had some times where, you know, they look to push him that extra innings, and maybe the bounces haven't gone his way, and it's kind of fallen apart a little bit on him. And I think that if you look at Wheeler, especially during the last 2 months when he seems to have turned the corner, his FIP and his ERA are right next to each other. And I would rather keep I'd rather keep Wheeler at this point. I think that he has less of an injury concern to me personally. I know that's a very subjective thing, but I'd rather have him. I'd rather have his velocity, and I think that the one thing that we absolutely have to give credit to the new brain trust of Callaway and Island. I think they've really done some excellent work with Wheeler and gotten him away from that constant nibbling. It seems like there was so many times in the past where he'd be up 0-2 or 1-2 on the batter, and he's trying to throw that perfect pitch low and away and hit the black, and instead he's trying to get the pitcher now to get himself out, you know, whether that's the breaking ball in the dirt or elevating the fastball, and I really like what I see from Wheeler, and I agree with you. My preference would be to keep the four starters going forward. However, if we had to trade one of them, I would rather trade Matz.
Yeah, and look, Callaway has not been a banner year for Callaway. I haven't disliked Callaway. I've defended him a little bit because I feel like all of a sudden now everybody who's ignored bad managing for about 7 years now is gonna pick on everything the guy does. Callaway to me hasn't done anything outstanding. He's done some things wrong, but the things he's done wrong aren't to the point where, let's put it this way, you switch Callaway and Aaron Boone, I don't think the team's records are any different. I really don't. I think things would feel different, and I guarantee you Aaron Boone, who's had some rough weeks that really haven't been dissected because the Yankees have won, would be under the same type of microscope. But what they have done, at least, and let's mind you that Wheeler is still a below-league average pitcher who's pitched a lot better in recent months, since maybe late April, early May. So he's not a league average pitcher yet in the whole totality of his work. But the fact that those guys finally seem to be maturing and evolving, and some of it's between the ears, which I don't feel the prior regime did anything to help evolve and develop these guys. I think if you had natural talent and you're able to harness that natural talent, I think you did well under those guys. I don't think anything else was really developed, and I think Callaway and Island have done that. To me, there's a value to that. Now, does that mean everybody's going to come up aces? They're not miracle workers. Matt Harvey had to go. It was always in my gut that Matt Harvey needed a fresh start. The Mets just wanted to make sure they exhausted every possibility before they let him go, because they didn't want to see him go somewhere else, regain his form, possibly, you know, dominate. And then you're saying, well, we could have had him here. It could have been us. We could have traded him. There was too much of a connection because of the first-round pick and the Dark Knight and all the things that they went through together. They tried to exhaust every possibility so it looked like it wasn't sustainable to even have him on the roster, which is why they traded him. You know, you're going to have your Anthony Swarzaks. You're going to have your misses. I'm not saying these guys are perfect, but I just think the fact that they've shown that they can work with what they have and improve it, especially with key assets like those two guys, young, controllable pitchers maximizing their talent, that to me is worth a bundle. And that's why I'm not really looking for them to, you know, chuck Callaway right away and bring in a Dusty Baker or Joe Girardi. I don't know if that kind of manager is going to make that much of a difference. I think he can learn to manage a better bullpen. I don't think his bullpen moves have been overly egregious. I think I like Island, and I like the things that Island has done, and historically he's done well when he's been in other organizations, including the Yankees. So I'd like to see this thing through, and I think with a little bit better luck and maybe a different type of mix both in the clubhouse and type of offensive players, look at how bad their offense has been. Their offense is competent. I'm telling you, these guys are maybe 10 games better. That doesn't mean they're in the race per se, but they're not out of it. Let's put it that way.
To me, we were talking about Callaway and whether he deserves the reputation that he's gotten so far here, where a lot of people are piling him on, and I really chuckled over the fact of over what you said about people who ignored bad managing for 7 years are now coming out of the woodwork, because that's extremely true. But to me, when I look at it, I almost see that his greatest strength so far has also led into perhaps his biggest failing. And the one thing that I loved about the Callaway Island regime is that they embraced the multi-inning reliever. And that's something that we absolutely did not see from Terry Collins and Dan Worthen. And the fact that they're throwing Gesellman and Lugo and other guys 2 and 3 innings at a time is exactly what this team needed. They need to embrace that long man role, whether that's a long man in mop-up situations or long man after a good 5-6 inning outing from a guy who's not in a position to give you any more. But at the same time, I think that they were looking for reasons to take starting pitchers out of the game. And I think that hurt them, and I think that contributed to that losing streak that we saw in May and June, where he was too eager to go to the bullpen, and he ended up blowing the bullpen out. So I hope that this is a learning experience for the two of them. And the one thing that I would like to see is, after the first start or two, we've got to stop with this babying of the starting pitchers. They've got to be throwing 100, 110 pitches and not, well, it's cold and we have to wait till the weather warms up. And like, well, they were 6 weeks in spring training and then now 2 or 3 outings. I mean, they should be ready to go at that point.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, especially early April. I mean, you were getting 3-inning starts. It was ridiculous. And you're right, that's what contributed a lot, even when they were winning early on, to a burnt-out bullpen. Look, he's going to have a full year with this group under his belt by the end of this season, going into next season. Next season is going to be critical. I'm assuming that they're going to put together at least moves that they're going to say we should have a winning club. Whether that club on paper meets the expectations of the media, the fans, or the prognosticators is another thing. But I think they're going to try to put together a winning club. Ownership will hire someone who's going to say, I'm going to tear this down and we got a 5-year rebuild. That would have to be a sell job. Now, granted, Callaway wasn't probably the favorite to get the managerial job, and he sold them. He sold them in that room. So to me, that, you know, he knows these guys now. He knows what they're all about. Everybody's learning each other, and it stinks because right now the Mets are in almost a win now because the controllability of these pitchers and their expense is going to go way up. They have a 2-year window. In a lot of ways, the manager they hired, Mickey Callaway, should have been the guy they hired back in 2011 when they were in purgatory, when they were trying to rebuild a club. They didn't need the caretaker. They didn't need the veteran manager. I never understood that move. And now is the time where you can make the argument where you want to bring in, similar to how the Nationals brought Davey Johnson in and said, we want to win now. Dusty Baker, was they had that whole situation. Man, we're going to win now, because Davey was a bit of a caretaker, was supposed to be, and he served both roles. So, you know, to me, this is a little bit imperfect, but I'd like to see him after a year with the mistakes, and I'm hoping that he can be honest enough with that and learn from those mistakes. I don't think the media particularly likes him. I know that for a fact. I don't know if Mickey has embraced the media in any way, and I think that's contributed to it. He's not nasty to them. He's indifferent, and I don't think they like that. I don't think he gives them a warm and fuzzy feeling, and believe me, that goes into and plays into how the coverage goes in this city. Always has been, always will be.
Now, you bring up a point I'd like to talk about, and that Callaway would have been the guy to hire in 2011, and obviously not Callaway. He wasn't ready to do that type of manager, exactly.
Right.
And to me, I partly agree with that. I don't think 2011 was the time for that. I think that they needed that caretaker in 2011. Just because things were just so cartoonish with Jerry Manuel. And, you know, he was talking about how he was a gangsta and all of this other stuff. And, you know, I was waiting for the Bobby Bonilla, let me show you the Bronx. I mean, there was just such unbelievable things going on, both in on the field management, and that was also the Tony Bernazard era, where he was taking off of his shirt and challenging guys to fight. And I think in 2011 they probably needed somebody to come in and give that kind veteran stabilizing thing, and they gave him a 2-year contract, and they should have let him serve his 2 years, and then they should have thanked him and give him the gold watch and send him off. And in 2013, I think, would have been the perfect time for the Callaway type manager.
You know, that I could agree with that too. The one mistake, and I said this on when I had I was a guest on AM 970 The Answer a few weeks back, that Sandy Olson made, and it's a total second guess, and we probably should have seen it at the time, but the Mets were in bad financial position post Madoff, and they were not looking to invest in that group. They had a lot of dead money. They had gone from, I guess, one of the top payrolls in 2009, and they were essentially looking to cut back. So instead of giving Wright, and I know this would have been unpopular, they let Reyes walk. They should have traded Reyes for prospects. And I was against that at the time because I kept saying, they could sign these guys. Why would you give up Reyes and Wright in their prime? And it's a total look back, and I know now it's easy to say, yeah, they should have. But they should have because they weren't going to invest in the team. They needed to move forward. Things had gotten so bad with the collapses and the negativity. And and I know that because the ownership, and this is my opinion, I don't know this for a fact, was so sensitive to the spending, they gave Wright the contract because it would have been too painful for them to see Wright traded for a bunch of maybes. But that would have been the move to make. Yes, they would have been bad. They may have been 100 loss or worse bad like the Astros. And we would not have been able to see David contribute and get to the World Series in 2015. But who knows what they could have gotten for him. And then you, even though the insurance has picked it up, you wouldn't have been saddled with this contract at this point. And who knows what kind of players you would have got. Of course, the course of Mets history is completely different, and maybe 2015 doesn't happen. But that's where I would say that would be the mistake. You should have just said, we're going to rip this thing completely apart. We're not going to invest in these guys. And even if we do, like Wright, by the time we get good, these guys are going to be in the back half. Now, they were young, so I guess Alderson's thinking, well, Wright will still be in his late prime and a healthy guy, and he didn't have a back problem at that time. So, you know, a little bit different scenario. But, again, I would have really liked to see what they could have gotten for those guys. Reyes might have been a little tougher because he was on the last year's contract in a pennant race, but I certainly think people would have paid for Wright and would have given the Mets some serious prospects for Wright.
Let's shift gears here. I want to talk a little bit about maybe comparison to two similar guys or guys who play the same position. And I want to start off with the catchers. Right now the Mets are running a platoon with Kevin Plawecki and Devin Mesoraco. And I want to know, what are your thoughts on those two guys, and do you have a preference for which one you want to see get the majority of the playing time the remainder of the season?
Oh, that's a tough one because I'm more of a catch. I'm a guy who likes catch and throw. I mean, not that I don't want them to hit, but I like catchers who can catch and throw, call a ball game, control the running game. And I don't know if those guys fall into that. They certainly don't on the throwing runners out situation. Mesoraco could pop you a home run, which Plawecki really can't. Plawecki might be a little bit more of a consistent hitter, at least, you know, from an OPS plus situation, it looks like that. I think Mesoraco gave them something in terms of what you could get from Matt Harvey, which was very little. But he's got a history of injuries. I don't think he can sustain and hold up and play every day. I don't particularly like the way he calls a ball game. I'm assuming, because I try to see through the, you know, by watching the game, that it's he calling the pitches, and I know he has called pitches, and I think he's made some critical errors with some of that with this staff. So I like a guy who's a good game caller, a leader, could throw runners out, and then what they give you offensively, those catchers, I'll be willing to take league average, or maybe slightly below in a good lineup, because I value that much. So I don't know if these are the guys that I'd hang my hat on long term. I think both are backups. I'm not sure Travis d'Arnaud is a starter either, although from a framing perspective, he certainly is missed. You could say that for sure, even though I know that people think that's overrated. Forget the metrics. Just look, watch the game. I think there's a lot of close calls that with d'Arnaud, the Mets pitchers would get. And d'Arnaud could hit a little bit, although he couldn't throw runners out. And I'm not sure it was his arm, which turned out to be the elbow that was the issue. I think it was his footwork to a certain degree. But, you know, to me, Plawecki and d'Arnaud or even Mesoraco are backups. I'd like to get a catch-and-throw guy to play a majority of the games. I don't know if that guy's out there. And this is a real tough hole. I think the Mets are going to have to figure out, you know, can they develop somebody? Can they trade for somebody, a veteran preferably, and get someone in there that could, you know, really lead and manage that pitching staff? Because I value that a lot. So, you know, nothing against these guys. They don't do enough of anything offensively to make up for what I feel is what the most critical aspects of catching is, which is the defensive side, the game calling side, and the leadership qualities.
Now, we've been pretty much in an agreement on most of the things we've talked about so far here tonight, but I think I'm going to have to take exception to some of what you're talking about with Mesoraco, because I feel like we took such a giant step forward when he came over, and his work with the pitchers, I think, is has to at least account for part of the step forward for both Harvey, I mean, not Harvey, excuse me, for Mattson Wheeler. I think he's displayed a take charge attitude behind the plate, and I like his game calling, and I think that his defense outside of his throwing, his throwing is not a huge plus, but it's at least as good as Darno's, and I've liked what the club has gotten from Mesoraco so far.
You know, that's fair, and again, I wouldn't mind him as a, I don't know if he could play every day. I mean, he's had a lot of serious injuries. And truthfully, you can do a lot worse. And right now, if you go on the free agent market and say, if the Mets don't have Mesoraco, who would they bring back? He probably is one of the top ones. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I just think they can do better. I don't know if that guy's available. And I'm not saying Mesoraco is horrible. I just would like, I mean, to me, defense up the middle is just so important, all the way up to center field. And I know it's a cliche, but teams that have good defense up the middle, go back and look at the 1999 Mets. Forget Piazza, because Piazza was pretty good at everything, similar to Mesoraco in that sense, what you're saying, except for throwing runners out. He was actually great at blocking pitches. I can't speak for the framing, but for what it's worth, Al Leiter loved throwing to him, so that says something. But that 99 team won because of defense up the middle, defense in the infield specifically. They took average pitchers, with the exception of Leiter, and maybe Reed was slightly above league average, but guys like Yoshi and Kenny Rogers, who, you know, were ground ball pitchers, and made them really tough because nothing got by them. So I always remember that, and I always feel like if you have strong defense up the middle, not at the sacrifice of a lot of offense, but of some, and I know this is not the way the game is played today, because you could say, oh, I got shifts, I could look at metrics, I could position players. Still, you know, range, there's something to be said with that. You can't put everybody everywhere. You don't know where the guy's going to hit the ball. So to me, I'm more about defense, but I don't think you're totally off. I don't think you're saying something egregious there. And listen, is Mesoraco a downgrade over Darno? I would say they're pretty even. I think Darno might be a better framer. And at the end of the day, who costs the less? Because I'm not sure either one of those guys, and Darno's probably not going to be healthy April 1, are worth breaking the bank for. You know, putting your money elsewhere if it's available would be an option.
So real quick, do you view Plawecki as a starting caliber catcher?
No.
Okay.
I don't. I mean, I could be wrong. He's never really gotten the chance, but offensively, no. I don't think he does anything. Let's put it this way. He doesn't do anything defensively that makes me say that offense, which is a different offense or maybe weighted is a little bit better than Mesoraco without the power, is worth the price of admission. So, no.
All right, and the second comparison I wanted to make is to the two outfielders, the two young outfielders that are actually born in the same year and in the same month, and that's Michael Conforto and Brandon Nimmo. Which one do you think has a brighter future?
I'm so down on Conforto. Overall, he's the better player, and I probably would say I have the brighter future. I think Nimmo's going to be more of a component player, leadoff guy, energy guy, on-base guy. Conforto, to me, could be the middle of the order, number three, number four hitter, who hits for average and power. But it's almost like if you look, his results this year, his output this year is identical. Look at his numbers. Go to Baseball Reference. Look at his numbers. A little bit more time in terms of plate appearances this year than in 2016, but it's almost the same. So we go good year, bad year, good year, bad year. Who's the real Michael Conforto? I understand he is coming off a serious injury, and maybe that played into he not getting all the spring training and things like that. But there's something to this. This isn't the first time this has happened. The numbers he's produced got him sent down in 2016. They talked about it at one point this year, sending him down. We're kind of at a crossroads here. Who's the real Michael Conforto, and can he return to the player that he was prior to separating his shoulder last August? if he is that guy, then you have yourself a cornerstone piece. The guy I see now is a platoon player. And to me, Nimmo, because of the intangibles he brings with his energy, because of his on-base ability, because I just think that he can bring so much more offensively in terms of different, you know, power on base, whereas Conforto has never shown that he can be the run producer that he really can be consistently. I would say, you know, right now, Nimmo, I hope that Conforto comes back, but I'm just so down on him right now, and I don't know what's wrong with him, and I don't know if it's approach, I don't know if it's his mental situation, is it, you know, because he had to rehab the shoulder that he didn't take enough reps over those 8 months. It's a very perplexing situation, Conforto. I don't want to give up on him, but things need to change fast, and if he doesn't improve by the end of this year, and you do go into next year with him as a starter, I think next year's it. I think he either has to show it or you need to move on.
Now, I want to change gears completely here, and we've been talking about guys on the current team. I want to talk about the farm system, and the farm system has taken a lot of grief. Coming into the year, we saw it rated, I think, as low as 27th or 28th in the majors. How would you rate the farm system today? Are you bullish on the chances of guys to come up and contribute?
I'm not a scout, and if you do want to get good coverage, I'll plug them. The MetsMinors.net guys, Michael Mayer over at MetsMinors.online, they do some great stuff. And the way for those who really – and these guys – and Michael covers, like he talks to scouts, he goes to games. Like he's not just looking at stats and numbers. He's really covering the minor leagues. What I'll say is this, that from what I understand, the lower levels produces or has potential, which means they're not big league ready, but there's potential down there. Outside of McNeil and Alonso, and you've seen some of the pitchers they brought up or the pitchers they've had to sign off the scrap heap, there's not a lot of – players that could impact the 25 or 40 man roster now, but I look at guys like Justin Dunn, Anthony Kay, David Peterson. These are young pitchers that maybe by this time next year, similar to Syndergaard and Mats, DeGrom, guys like that, when they came up in 14 and 15, could impact. Look, nobody was talking about those guys, even Mats and Syndergaard, the year before the World Series run, as guys that you could plug into rotation and compete at a high level. They were having good years. Actually, Syndergaard was struggling in the minor leagues, if you remember correctly, that season. There was doubts about him. Mats was having a good year in Double-A Binghamton. So, you know, I look at it in a similar sense where let's see what next year brings. If those pitchers develop, I'm bullish on them now having a better depth or guys that could plug in and maybe give them number three starter numbers, where right now it's such a drop-off. We'll see what Corey Oswalt becomes, but you know, there's such a drop-off when they start somebody like Flexen or something like that. I mean, there's not even competitive games at that point. Thomas Nittle's been a huge disappointment. You know, we talked about catching before, and you know, we didn't even bring him up. That tells you what, you know, how he performed when he was up here. But you got guys like Andrés Giménez, Jared Kelnick now is getting a lot of play after a really hot start. So I think in the lower minors, there's a lot of potential. I think McNeil and Alonso are going to be the key guys for the upper levels now and who can contribute now and into next year. But I think the Mets drafts and their prospects in terms of who can impact, it's going to be more of a 2020, 2021. And maybe at the end of the day, that's where the biggest knock on Sandy Alderson, the drafts that he had. Yeah, you have Lugo and Gazelman and Nimmo now has contributed, so you started to see that bear some fruit. But in general, there just hasn't been enough. I'm not talking about stars, just even quality contributors in some of those drafts from 11, 12, 13, and 14 that you could turn around and say, yeah, you know, the Mets have done a good job here. So I think we'll see what happens in the next 3 to 4 years. But right now, you're hanging your hat on McNeil and Alonso.
I think Mets fans got really spoiled where we had a stretch where 1 year they brought up Harvey, and the next year they brought up Wheeler, and the next year they brought up DeGrom, and the next year they brought up Syndergaard. And that doesn't happen. I mean, right. that was so incredibly nice, right, to have that run where they just kept bringing up one star after another after another. And let's face it, that's why they made the World Series in 2015.
Yeah. Because it's very uncommon. That's why I don't want to give them up. That's why I really would measure twice, cut once before I gave up on those guys and traded them. And you better be right. You know, when they traded R.A. Dickey, they got very fortunate because if you remember, Syndergaard was a guy they wanted, but they weren't sure about. It was Darno. So you just don't know what you're going to get. You just don't know. And there were other guys in that deal, the Dickey deal particularly, that Toronto gave up that had some promise that never panned out. So, you know, it's very hard to project. And prospects are just that, prospects. They're not guarantees. And we often forget that.
One of the things that I go round and round with on people is that they don't have an appreciation for what we were just talking about, that great run that the Mets had of guys that they promoted. And that's by far the exception and not the rule. And actually, Sandy Alderson's draft record has been pretty good. It's been one of the strengths of his department. And you say that whether you look at the sheer number of guys who've come up or the guys who've come up and actually produced. So you mentioned Kelnick. He's off to a great start. Hopefully we'll see him. And you mentioned some of the other pitchers that he's drafted here. And, you know, we might have a lull, you know, right now and next year, depending, I guess, on when Dunn is going to make his debut and when Alonso will make his debut. But I think there's a lot of talent percolating at the A level, and I think that 2-3 years from now we're going to see another run of high quality guys coming up. And I think that's one of the things for the people, and I'm not one of these people, but one of the things that people who are saying, well, they should trade away guys, they should more on the side of blowing it up rather than just trade the expiring contracts, is that because there's nothing available in the next year, two and a half years, that they should time it so that all of those guys are ready and hitting the majors at the same time, like we saw with the Astros.
Yeah, and but that doesn't mean it's going to happen. And everyone's like, now, well, you got to build it like the Astros and the Cubs. And I remember back in 2003, after the Marlins won, everybody was saying, well, you got to win with speed at the top of the order. And then the Red Sox win the next year, and it's all about on-base percentage. And then the Mets win in 2015 and go to the World Series. Well, it's about starting pitching. And then the Cubs win, and it's about offense. Like, there's not one way to win. There's just never been. And you know, the Mets could do things, and I know that that's making people laugh because they're like, look at the history, look at the bad luck. But maybe the Mets, and if I'm a GM, I look at this roster, and maybe I'm being simplistic here, and maybe I'm being naive. I would be completely honest if I thought there was nothing here. I really would. I'm not here to put glasses on, blue and orange glasses, and blow smoke and say that, you know, everything's all right. Anyone who's listened to me for 10 years knows that that's not my thing. I just look and I say, yeah, there's opportunities here, and yes, there are holes. And I think offensively, they have to look and see how they could remake this offense. I think some of these pitchers in the bullpen have potential if they develop and are used properly. I don't think you have to go out. Look at the Rockies, all the money they spent on bullpen arms, and that's not really yielded anything for them. You know, there's been some bad luck here. I trust in Callaway and Island to develop those guys. So, you know, to me, a challenge for anybody coming in would be, in the next couple of years, can you make something out of this? The rebuild will be there. You can blow this thing up 2 years from now, 3 years from now, tomorrow. I don't see where the opportunity lost is. Yeah, okay, maybe the threat is you have another bad 2018, 2017 type season in 2019, and nobody wants to go through that, but I don't think that's a guarantee that that's going to happen. There's going to be prospects. There's going to be teams looking for starting pitching. This idea that Jacob deGrom can't be traded for the same value next year as he is this year is nonsense. Oh, well, you get three pennant races instead of two at him. Well, somebody wants an elite starting pitcher to win a championship, they're not going to care that he has two instead of three. They're going to get him because there's going to be another team that's right up there trying to get him with them. There's, you know, I've heard people say, and I know it's funny, and I think they're joking, but I don't know. Well, Bryce Harper increased his free agent value because of a home run derby, and Jacob deGrom got hit because of a home run in the All-Star game. We're at a point where we're judging people on nonsense? Really? I mean, I know that we're in a media age where we have to fill time, but could we be mature, or are we, you know, 6 years old here? Because I got to tell you, I see a lot of six-year-old type of thought processes being thrown out there by supposedly intelligent writers and bloggers and fans and, you know, and what have you. So, you know, I don't mean to insult anybody, but, you know, at the end of the day, to this idea that you cannot win with this roster, you could only win one way, and it's this way. That's the same kind of thinking that used to annoy the analytics crowd when they were on the outside and not the mainstream like they are today.
Well, speaking of six-year-olds, we've reached the crazy prediction time. And we have a segment on the podcast where I'll start off, I'll give you a crazy prediction of mine, and then I'll ask you to comment on it, and then I'll ask you to give me a crazy prediction of your own. And, you know, maybe we're overshooting it here. Maybe it's more four-year-olds than six-year-olds. But I don't know. I've been doing the crazy predictions a year and a half, 2 years now, and I don't think any one of them has come true. So I'm due to come true on one of them. Just by numbers. But my crazy prediction is that the Mets are going to trade Michael Conforto. So what do you think?
I don't think that's crazy. I don't think that's crazy. I don't know if it's going to happen in July. I don't know if they would get the best value out of him. You might have to package him with the pitcher. I would hope that there was a big upside to including him at his lowest point. But you know, a new guy comes in as a general manager, has no attachment to him. They didn't see him come up through the organization. They didn't draft them. He wasn't part of their World Series or pennant winning team. So, yeah, I don't think that's crazy at all. I as far as crazy, believe me, I've seen John Harper columns, all due respect to John, that are far more crazy than Michael Conforto getting traded by you. But so that's not the worst crazy prediction. I haven't listened to the other ones. But I'm assuming that's one of the more sane or logical ones. So maybe that's the one that – maybe your streak ends on that one.
There you go. Fair enough. All right. Well, show me what a crazy prediction is like.
All right. Well, I'm going to throw you two. So I'll give you kind of two for the price of one. The first one is this. Don't be surprised the Mets bring back Daniel Murphy this offseason. Maybe to play first base. Maybe to play third base if Frazier gets traded. I don't think he could play second base full time, but maybe they bring Murphy back. Because I don't think Murphy's going to have a lot of offers out there because of the knee. If he doesn't go to the American League, I wouldn't be surprised that the Mets try to sneak in because he's the kind of bat, and I think they may want to see if they can get something from that World Series run out there. And then the second thing is, and this is probably the crazier of the two, don't be surprised they try to, and I know he's got a no-trade clause, try to move on from Cespedes because he may be the guy that, if you talk about remaking the offense and moving in a different direction while not blowing the team up, his money and his presence and his dynamic might be the thing that you could change on that whole thing.
Well, I would not be the least bit surprised if they were calling every single club that they had a phone number for, trying to find someone to take Cespedes off their hands. So I don't think that one's crazy. I do think that the Mets, after all the trouble that they've had with injuries the past few years, taking on a Daniel Murphy who, I mean, we just played the Nationals and Murphy looked like a cripple. And
yeah,
and
it's a risk. That's why it's a crazy prediction.
I would say that
the Cespedes one might be more logical. The Cespedes one would be interesting because you would have to say, hey, I don't want any prospects. I just need you to take the money. And you go to an American League team. It'd have to be an American League team. And then take that money and you free it up. And you're going to look. You're on that scenario, you're banking on Conforto returning, Nimmo being somewhat of a dynamic player and a power, you know, I don't want to say speed, but he does a decent speed on base. You'd have to go out and maybe look at an A.J. Pollock, who's also an injury risk as a free agent. You know, you're losing a lot of power there. Or you're admitting, hey, you know, maybe Jay Bruce, even though he's got 2 years left on the contract and has some hip issues, we could get 30 home runs out of him. I don't know the underlying issues with his health. He certainly has plantar fasciitis. So and this is where I guess it gives credence to those that don't want to stay the course like I do with the pitching. They're looking at all the plans to rebuild as risky propositions. And I agree. But, you know, I really would feel like you know, it's such criminal, and it bothers me so much to have this gift of these pitchers that you never expected, just to give it away and not have one or two more playoff runs that I think that I expected at least one more playoff run since, you know, the 2016 wild card game.
I think the Mets would do that in a heartbeat, and that would be trading Cespedes if someone took his contract. I think if you had framed it as someone will take Cespedes' contract, then I would have given you a crazy.
You know, it's tough, but you know, you have to look at the health, and you have to say, is a team thinking that they can take Cespedes on, they have some extra money, and they don't have to give up prospects? If you're asking to give up prospects or anything, no, they're not going to do that. Maybe the Mets look at it and say, we'll eat, you know, XYZ portion of it. Look, Cespedes would have to approve it, so that's the big thing here.
Right.
The crazy part is, I don't know if Cespedes wants to leave. Spring training's near his home in Florida, so now you have to narrow the teams down to teams that are near his home in Florida, you know, that do Florida spring training. That narrow, because most teams will go to Arizona now. Florida's becoming a graveland, you know, graveyard. You know, Houston was interested in him. I don't know if they need him now. So it is crazy. And you know, maybe the Murphy one's more realistic. I don't know. So in general, all I can say about the Murphy part of it is you're right. He does look gimpy, but sometimes those injuries, same injury that Justin Turner had, the microfracture surgery, they take some time to heal. And maybe as the season goes on, he'll look a little bit healthier as he gets deeper and moves further away from the surgery and the rehab.
We're talking with Mike Silva, and I'm having a great time, but I just want to check in and make sure that you've got time for one, maybe two more questions.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely not a problem.
All right, well, I want to talk about Jose Bautista, and I was 100% against the Mets signing him, and he's been so much better than what I anticipated. I anticipated he was going to be every bit as bad as Adrian Gonzalez, and he's been the exact opposite of that. He's been willing to play in both the infield and the outfield, shown a great eye at the plate, has started to hit a few balls over the wall, and seems to be hustling every time he's on the field. And it's been a revelation to watch him play. But he's not really somebody who fits on the team going forward. So what do they do with Jose Bautista?
Well, if Cespedes decides he wants to play possum the rest of the year and not come back, they almost need him. I'm not in favor of, and I know this is another thing that's probably not going to be popular, I think winning is important. I think winning in the second half, and the goal in the second half should be, if Cespedes comes back and they have a relatively healthy team with Frazier back, go out there, compete, and win. You know, ruin some Septembers. You know, make life miserable. Make teams say, you know, I got to come in, I need these games to win the division. If I'm the Phillies or the Braves or, you know, a team competing for the wild card, I got to face Syndergaard, DeGrom, Mats. That's a real hassle. Look at the Yankees. They're not going to be happy about facing those three guys. I don't care what their fans say about the Mets. And if Jose Bautista being on that roster helps them achieve that goal, and there's no market for him to get anything of value. Now, if you want to give him away for cash or for organizational filler, to me, that's a waste. If you could keep him and he's a positive in that locker room and he's a positive out on the field, and I don't know if he's a positive in the locker room. I haven't heard he's a negative, but I think he's more mercenary from the description that I've heard of him, like more to himself, go out, play, go home. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, as long as he contributes and does the things you've seen over the last couple of weeks. Because I think winning and having the best possible second half is important for Mickey Callaway. It's important for the organization to build on that for next year. Not be fooled by it, but build by it, build on it. And if Bautista does that, and he does that in a part-time role or being a pseudo-Cespedes, which he's been over the last month, you know, then I'm all for it, keeping him around.
I like winning, but I don't think that the organization should necessarily chase wins here in the second
not
half.
Not irresponsibly. No, that's true. Well, no, I don't mean irresponsibly. Not at the expense of development, but I wouldn't embarrass myself for a higher draft pick. I guess let me make myself clear on that.
All right, so I guess the thing that I come back to is last year, similar circumstance where they were not really competing for a playoff position down the stretch, and then they picked up Nori Aoki, who had been released twice, and Aoki was really good. He had I haven't looked at the numbers, but I'm somewhere in the ballpark of a 360 on base percentage. Was definitely a positive if you just looked at the 2017 season, but there was absolutely no chance he was going to be on the 2018 club So why was he playing ahead of somebody who might possibly could have won himself a spot on the 2018 club? Maybe we
fair point.
At Philip Evans completely different if they had let him go out and play in the outfield in Aoki's spot. And I just wonder if we're in the same spot here with Bautista. And nothing
it's
against
possible.
Bautista. Nothing.
No,
against
that's him. and that's a very fair point. And maybe I mean that's what some fans and media members have said. Well, did you know Brandon Nimmo was this good? Because maybe you wouldn't have. And let's see Brandon Nimmo's second time around the league. He's never played a full season yet, so let's just temper that. I mean, he's been, you know, I think he'll be okay, but that doesn't mean anything. Maybe you would have known what you had at Brandon Nimmo, and if you gave Brandon Nimmo more exposure. I personally think that Aoki was somebody they were looking at as some affordable outfield depth for this year. I think they were looking at him as a possibility, as crazy as that is. So, you know, I don't think it was like, let me just fill them in to win games. I think they were serious about that. They have, I don't know how big their analytics department is. I've heard it's, you know, from reports, it's not that big. They do, and a lot of the moves they made, the Chris Becks, the Neil Ramirez's over the last year, have been analytics department moves where in a vacuum there may be some statistical validation or reason for making the move, but then you look at it in a real-life practical sense, you're like, Neil Ramirez stinks, and I know I say that now, and he's doing well in Cleveland, and Chris Beck stinks, you know? So what's going on here? So, you know, maybe to a certain degree, that's where, you know, Aoki falls into. But, you know, look, I'm with you. I don't mind keeping – if you're just going to give him away for cash or for a filler, to me, keep him around if he's going to be useful, even if it's in a part-time role. I don't see a need to just rip the roster apart for a higher draft pick. I don't want them to be embarrassed. I do want them to go out there and compete, even if they lose. How you lose and the process of losing, I think, is just as important. If that, you know, I know that sounds corny, but that's something I really believe in.
All right, and my last question for you tonight is two of the guys that they signed as free agents here in the offseason who've had some injury problems and production problems too, and that's Todd Frazier and Anthony Swarzak. Do you have any hope for either of those being productive members of the team going forward?
I like Frazier. You know, before he got hurt the second time, his numbers weren't, you know, too far off from historically where he was, even with last year with the Yankees. Then I looked a little dive deeper. Other than April, he's been really bad, so that tells you a lot. Maybe they've, because of the Cespedes injury, elevated him to a higher part in the lineup than he is. I think he's a seven-hitter. He's a guy that's going to give you some pop, not going to hit for high average, give you really good defense, leadership. He's a you know, grinder, and who I advocated early in the offseason to signing. So I wasn't somebody I just jumped on board late. And I think the injuries probably have had to play something. I think he was hurting way before he let on. That had to play into his production. The fact that he went back on the disabled list. So this guy's probably been hurt for the better part of 3 months. I think Frazier will be okay. Now, Swarzak was not the guy that I was thinking about going into the offseason. I like Joe Smith personally, and I wanted them to re-sign Addison Reed because I liked him. And Addison Reed hasn't had a great year in Minnesota. And now he seems to be having some tendonitis and maybe having some arm issues.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.